From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, well, we find out why our soldiers are getting the short end of the stick with the VA, and also some severe weather heading north of St. Louis. If you're starting to track it, it's around Springfield, Missouri right now. We've got the generators up and running just in case. To keep this program on for you. Australian authorities researching, of course, the continued missing Malaysia Flight 370. They will release an audio recording of an underwater sound that they say could possibly be related to the final moments of the missing plane, but they're just not sure. They say it's a long shot. Researchers at the Curtin University near Perth, Australia, have been studying records from underwater listening devices, including those meant to monitor for signs of underwater explosions in an effort to find the missing plane. They say one signal has been detected on several receivers. Researchers have been analyzing the very low-frequency sound for weeks to see if it was the impact of an aircraft on the water or the implosion of parts of the aircraft as it sank. They stress it's likely to be a natural event. They're just not sure. They had something to prove to someone they found on a ghoulish website. So two girls lured a third girl into a wooded area in Wisconsin over the weekend and stabbed her 19 times. The suspects left the victim to crawl to her own rescue. The three girls, all 12 years old, were friends. A bicyclist found the wounded girl alive, lying on a sidewalk. She's now in stable condition at a hospital. Now, the girls are trying to impress a certain slender man, according to the complaint. One of the girls encountered the name on a website known as Creepy Pasta Wiki, which posts horror stories. Unbelievable. The Los Angeles area feeling more earthquakes this year. Now, after a relatively quiet period of seismic activity in the LA area, the last 5 months have been marked by five earthquakes larger than 4.0. That has not occurred since 1994, the year of the very destructive Northridge earthquake that produced 53 such tremors. Cal Ory, of course, author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes. Let's check in with Cal. Cal, what does this mean to you, the fact that L.A. is getting more earthquakes than they've had since 94?
I read tonight that this could be an earthquake storm or a cluster, not an aggressive, aggressive quake after quake after quake, but, you know, one after another in the course of 3 months. I sense that it's leading up to something big, and I know I keep saying that it's getting old, but I say 50% in June before summer, and I noticed Jim Berkland's seismic windows coming up, the full moon, on June 12th to the 19th, right before summer, like I said. So I say be prepared. I'm going to say 50% probability is my forecast that we're going to see something greater than what we have. On March 29th, we had a 5.1, and then March 17th, a 4.4, and then we just had this upgraded 4.2. That was widely felt by more than 3,000 people that reported feeling it. And these quakes are all coastal in greater Los Angeles, which I did forecast. So it's a heavily populated area. And if it's a major quake, 7.0, we're looking at a potential tsunami.
Jeez. Now, what are the odds of a 7.0 or more?
I'm going to say 50%. I don't want to cause panic. I say be ready, duck, cover, chill. Don't, just chill if it does happen. But everybody knows we're on shaky ground. It's just a matter of when.
And Cal, let me ask you, the complexity of earthquakes, do they slowly build with, 3.0s, 4.0s, before historically a big earthquake, a 7-plus, has happened?
Oftentimes they can, and in the 1989 quake that Jim Berkland did predict, we did have a foreshock in August, a strong quake that I felt, a 5, before we had the 6.9 to 7.1. So I say a lot of times yes, sometimes no. But in this case, if I was living in Southern California, I would definitely see it as a heads up, don't ignore it.
Okay, Cal, thank you so much. And, of course, Jim Berkland, geologist, has predicting major earthquakes as well. New orders for U.S. factory goods rose for a third straight month in April. Hey, this is good news. It does point to some strength in manufacturing and the broader economy. And look, right about now, let's take all the good news in the economy we can get. Scientists, get ready for this one. We'll be ready to create babies from three people in around 2 years if it's made legal. The technique would be used to prevent deadly diseases. They say that's why they really want to do this. A reality show is going to send people to Mars with no hope of return. You've heard that story. We've been following it on Coast to Coast, but a new reality show will follow the selection, training, and eventual one-way 300-million-mile trip to Mars for those who are lucky enough to get there. But they're not coming back. Let's check in with space historian Robert Zimmerman. Well, Robert, I think it was just a matter of time that these reality shows would catch up with this one, too, huh?
Yeah, I would say so, George. I would also say that I wouldn't take this too seriously. To me, the more exciting story this week was the announcement, the unveiling by SpaceX of their Dragon capsule that's actually going to take people into space.
And we
this
need
is
that.
Just a publicity stunt. They're going to do stuff. They're going to have a nice television show, but they have no hardware to get them anywhere, and they're definitely not going to have hardware by 2025. In fact, the only company that might get them the hardware is SpaceX with its Dragon capsule and its Falcon Heavy rocket. And so from my perspective, we should be focusing on what's really being built right now that's going to put the United States in space.
Now, the mission to Mars, though, by sending people there, they're going through a selection process now, not necessarily for the reality show, where they will go one way. Is that going to happen?
Well, you see, that's what I mean. They're not building hardware. It's just publicity stunt. They originally got 200,000 applicants. They've weeded it down to about 705 candidates, they say. They're going to obviously film those candidates as they take tests and they do various outdoor activities to show how wonderfully good astronauts they might be. But that's not building a spacefaring society. What's building a spacefaring society is building rockets and spaceships. And this is not doing that at the moment. I'm not against them doing it. I know there are going to be fans of your show and fans of my website, Behind the Black, who will be annoyed at me by being so negative about this. But I have to say, I want to focus on what we can do and what will actually get us there rather than publicity stunts.
Well, we've got some time, Mr. Zimmerman, to talk about this one, don't we?
yes, they'll be playing this game for the next decade. And you know what? They might actually be ready to fly in their reality show when the real spaceships being built by SpaceX and other companies arrive. And then we'll put them two together, and boy, we'll be flying to Mars. It'll be great.
You got it. Thanks, Robert. You know, back in 2008 when we had the financial debacle, we looked at various ways that the economy was changing, fixed, and we looked at things that were going on in corporate America. Up next, David K. Johnston joins us. We're going to be talking about his research and his work, Financial Secrets, next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, get ready for a riveting couple hours here on Coast to Coast AM tonight. David K. Johnston has been long time America's leading investigative reporter. He is the board president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors. He is best known for his exposés of the American tax system. And to this day, David continues revealing some wrongdoing and stealth government policies that take from the many to benefit the already rich. David is a contributing editor at Newsweek, columnist for Al Jazeera America, also teaches the law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law. David, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Glad to be here.
Good. Now, let's take an overall, first and foremost, about just what's going on with this, what I consider to be, David, a haves and have-nots society, and it seems to be growing. That disparity is getting wider and wider. Of course, the middle class is shrinking. And, you know, with corporate America tossed in there, where are we headed, in your opinion, over the next 5 years?
Well, we are, because of government rules, going to see much worse conditions overall for the bottom half of Americans, and we're going to see a continued concentration at the top. And let me just give you, George, a couple of simple indicators of that. These come from the official IRS data. All right, everything I do, I work from the official government data. Coming out of the Great Depression, which officially ended in 1933, the next year, 1934, the bottom 90% of Americans saw their income go up by almost 9%. That's a huge increase.
Yes, it is.
And the top 1% saw their income go down a little bit. Well, we're, now let's look at what happened after the Great Recession, which officially ended June 30th, 2009, which will be 5 years ago at the end of this month. We only have data through 2012, but that only ended about 16 months ago, 17 months ago. Well, the bottom 90% of Americans saw their income fall. Their income is down by about 2%. That's a week's income. But the people at the top have done incredibly well. In fact, of all the increased income that every one of us, about 316 million Americans, had, a third of it went to 16,000 households.
Jeez.
Yeah. 95,
which is nothing.
That's right. Absolutely nothing. 95% of it went to the top 1% of households. The rest of it went basically to the next 4 percentage points. And when you get to the 90th rung on the income ladder, you're now into the territory of incomes going down. Now, we're talking about statistical groups and over different periods of time. But what this tells you is that coming out of really hard economic times back in the 30s, we began an era of widespread prosperity that continued for decades. And coming out of the Great Recession, we are heading into a period in which the gains are going to be at the top. And the reason the gains are going to the top has to do with government policies, hundreds of rules and regulations that either have never made the news or have only minimally made so, that have been the subject of books that I have been writing for years, where I dig in and figure out how these things work, and I can certainly give you lots of examples.
Okay, and let me ask you, this 1%, with the money they make, do they fuel the economy, David, with their spending, or do we have to rely on that 90-plus percent of the people who don't make a lot of money who just buy goods and services?
Right. Well, let me just break down your question a little bit, all right? The top 1% starts at about $360,000. Now, to a lot of people, that's a lot of money, but they're really nothing to do with what's going on within the top 1%. It's the top 10th and the top 100th of 1%. I mean, the top 1% of the top 1% that really matter. The top 10th of 1%, that's 1 in 1,000 Americans. Their income starts at about $2 million a year, and that group, 1 in 1,000 Americans, has almost as much income as the bottom 156 million Americans. So 300 and some thousand people on one side, 156 million on the other, roughly equal incomes. Now, the top 1% of the top 1%, that's a group Mitt Romney is near the bottom of.
Oh, he's their the bottom? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Their income starts at about $10 million a year. And that group's share of income in this country has been growing, as has the top one-tenth of 1%. Back from 1934 to 1980, the bottom 90% averaged almost two-thirds of all the reported income in the country. They've now fallen to below half of that. So 90% of the people used to have about two-thirds of the income. Now they have less than half. So the problem is that people who are in this class of 2 million above, the top 10th of 1% and the top 100th of 1%, they couldn't possibly consume and spend the incomes they have unless they want to gamble it away. You can't spend it on drugs at that level of income. You know, the drugs will kill you before you've consumed very much.
That's right.
And so what they do is they invest and reinvest their income. And we have all these vehicles that allow very wealthy people to roll over their money, not pay taxes and reinvest. So it's like a snowball going downhill. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as a result, we have this enormous distortion in our economy. About every 90 days, the Federal Reserve announces something called the Flow of Funds Report. And if you watch the various news services like CNBC that cover financial news, they'll announce the new number. And lately, it's been a little less than $2 trillion of cash and what's called near cash, things companies can sell in a day or two and turn into cash, that American corporations hold. The problem with that number is that it's only what they hold domestically. If you look at all the offshore money that American corporations are holding, over $7 trillion of cash.
Ugh.
$7 trillion. And they're not reinvesting that money in ways that create jobs. Instead, they're doing something absolutely bizarre. The multinational corporations have figured out literally how to make a profit off the corporate income tax. And here's how it works. Imagine, George, you ran Nuri Inc.
Okay.
And you had a $1 billion tax bill due this year. But you had been clever enough in the past to take your photograph and the logos for your show, and you had moved them to your subsidiary offshore. It could be the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Singapore. It depends on the deal you've made.
Okay.
And so you pay all your profits offshore as a royalty. You pay it out of your American pocket into your, let's say, Cayman Islands pocket where you own your intellectual property. Now you don't owe any current U.S. income taxes because Congress doesn't count that as profits, even though you tell your shareholders you made the profit. So now you got $1 billion of money you will owe in taxes sitting offshore. And what do? Well, you pick up the phone, you call Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase or one of his subordinates and say, hey, what do I do with this money? I mean, I can't risk it because someday I will have to pay taxes.
I need it, yeah.
Yeah. And they'll say, oh, we got a perfect solution for you. Because Congress didn't get your $1 billion of tax money, they spent it anyway, so now they have $1 billion worth of debt to sell you. Well, you have to ignore at the moment our currently artificially reduced interest rates. If you can earn 4% on that money for 30 years and inflation is 3%, here's what happens to you with your $1 billion 30 years from now. And remember, these are corporations. They don't die.
And do you have access? Do you have access to the money if you need it?
Because you have many pockets of this, you're allowed to borrow it by Congress for short periods of time. So you borrow some from pocket A, and then you send it back after 60 days, and then you borrow from pocket B, and you send it back. So effectively, you have interest access to this if you need to spend it. But now, if you go forward 30 years with compound interest, your $1 billion account is now $3.4
billion. Wow.
So let's say you pay your tax at this point. 30 years in the future. Well, the government gets $1 billion, except in the dollars 30 years from now, it's only going to be worth $400 million. So as taxpayers, we're going to get $400 million, but we've paid out $2.4 billion, six times as much money, forgetting the inflation for the moment.
Are they all doing this, David?
They're all doing it. And then you have the $2.4 billion left. You reduce that for inflation. It's $1 billion. And every big multinational is doing this. If you are George Nuri, American domestic company, you can't do this. But if you're Nike or General Electric or Apple or any of the 2,800 biggest American companies, all of which have international operations, you can do this. You literally make a profit off your taxes. When I first reported this when I was at the New York Times 12 years ago, my editors had a hard time believing this, and they very cautiously edited the story that ran on the front page. It was about how Enron didn't pay taxes. Well,
I remember that story.
Yeah. Congress has something called the Joint Committee on Taxation with a lot of expert lawyers and accountants on it, and they did the biggest study in their history. They produced a four-volume, 1,800-page report. And it showed exactly what I just told you, and it showed that Enron literally referred to its tax department as a profit center. The reason you hear these news stories these days that say, oh, this big company paid a 1% tax or a 3% tax on its profits is, actually, if you understand the time value of the money, They're not paying any tax. We're paying them.
That's amazing. David, stay with us. We're going to hit this break, come back and talk a little bit more about what's happening. I wonder if we can get this changed where some of that money should rightfully come back to us. We're going to come back in a moment and talk more with David K. Johnston on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. David K. Johnston with us. David's books, by the way, you can find them all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Perfectly Legal, The Fine Print, Free Lunch. There seems to be a free lunch going on here, David, huh?
Yes, and it's the result of our debate by Congress and the people you see on the network television talking about things without understanding how the rules actually work. Everything I just said in the earlier segment is to anyone who is deeply involved in tax and understands corporate tax, totally non-controversial. They wouldn't dispute the facts in there. But to the public, I'm sure that it's very jarring because, you know, who has ever heard a politician get up and denounce the idea that corporations, literally multinational corporations, literally profit off the income tax? Let me give you another one, George. In 20 states, corporations now can make deals to keep the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks, in effect, taxing their workers. So instead of your money going to pay for schools and courts and all the other things state governments do, your employer can keep it. There are almost 3,000 companies that have these deals. They're basically every big brand name company in America that you've ever heard of, and a lot of foreign companies, Mitsubishi, Nissan, the big communist Chinese bank, CIBI, they all have these deals. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp has them. And the workers do not know about this because once the taxes are withheld from your paycheck, you are treated under the law as having paid your taxes, even if your employer goes belly up, unless you're involved in some fraud scheme.
Right.
And the companies do this by they get a tax credit equal to the taxes that are withheld from their workers' paycheck.
Withheld. That's right.
Right.
What a great deal that is, too. My gosh.
Yeah, well, it's easy to make a profit if you do that. General Electric, which is the only company that I found any record of ever telling its workers about this deal, they're getting 92% of the cost of refurbishing an Ohio factory from the taxpayers. So think about that. If they make an 8% annual profit on the money, the cost of that factory, an 8% return on the investment, since
right.
their cost is 8%, that means they make 100% annual return on their equity.
That's a pretty good
that
deal.
Factory.
Great deal.
The average return for all businesses for their assets is 7% a year.
I don't see this changing, though, David. I don't see legislation that would stop this. If anything, I think it'll continue to go their way.
Well, I would agree with you, although, you know, as Herbert Stein, Richard Nixon's chief economic advisor, famously said 40-some years ago, a trend will continue only so long as it can continue. And at some point, you will begin to see owners of domestic companies, for example, and I know a few of them who will begin shouting and complaining about this to politicians. You'll see workers begin to learn about this. And instead of going, oh, well, I don't care, as I've had workers tell me, begin to say, wait a minute, I don't like paying taxes, but I certainly don't want to pay taxes to the company that I work for. So, but I think we're a long way from stopping this kind of behavior.
What's going on in the world of, by the way, I'm opposed to our present taxation system. I think we should go to a different kind of tax system so people can have.
What would you tax?
I would tax goods. I'd go to a fair tax.
So you want to shift the tax burden even further off the wealthiest Americans and onto people who are truck drivers and school teachers.
No. The wealthy Americans, if they buy things, will be paying those taxes too.
Yeah.
I would set up a voucher system for those who are poorer, who can't afford things.
But George, this is a very well-studied subject. A consumption tax, which is what you're describing.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is.
It is absolutely a regressive tax. And I'll give you a real simple example of this. In 49 of the 50 states, the poorest 20% of households pay a larger share of their income to state government in taxes than the top 1%. Every state except one. Because if you have an income of $100 million a year, and remember, we live in a country where just in the hedge fund industry, there are two dozen people who make $1 billion each year just from their hedge funds that they run. You don't consume anywhere near that kind of income. It's very difficult to spend more than a few million dollars. So your tax burden, nothing, who cares? I mean, it would be irrelevant to you. If you don't have an income tax on large incomes, and that's what we originally intended to do in 1913, then you are putting the burden on people who can least bear it, and you are, in effect, giving a huge giveaway by the government to people who are already very, very wealthy.
It is a puzzlement, as they say in The King and I.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about the sports teams, too. We're going to go through a whole litany of things if we can, David. Do you say that a lot of sports owners are getting taxpayer money? How's that happening? Do you mean in the assistance of stadiums and things like that?
Oh, in a whole variety of different ways. First of all, we've had a huge era here now, two decades of stadium building. And careful studies done by scholars who specialize in this area have shown that 79% of all the money spent on these stadiums came from the taxpayers. For some sports like soccer, many of the stadiums were 100% taxpayer financed because there's no evidence of enough ticket revenue to finance any stadium. In Cleveland on May 6th, Cuyahoga County, which is Cleveland and its near-in suburbs, people voted to renew for 20 years a tax that goes to the three billionaire, out-of-town billionaire owners of the local basketball, baseball, and football teams. Every time you get a beer or a shot of whiskey or cigarettes, you pay a small tax, and it goes to subsidize these teams. And these teams then are raising their prices so that people cannot afford to attend the games in many cases. For example, last October, when the Denver Broncos played in Indianapolis, the average price of a ticket, and when I first heard this, I didn't believe it, so I went and downloaded all the ticket prices and calculated this. The average price of a ticket for that football game was $467, and the cheapest ticket was $164.
Jeez.
Yeah. So the sports teams all across America, the big four sports, baseball, basketball, hockey, and football, they are huge welfare programs that redistribute money upward to the team owners. And look what we just saw, the NBA Clippers.
$2 billion.
Steve Ballmer's offered to buy them for, it's a basketball team, for $2 billion.
And you know he'll make money on that.
Yep.
Or he wouldn't be involved.
It is, I mean, it's very troubling. And you know, George Bush, years ago I wrote about his financial statements and showed that more than two-thirds of his fortune came from the Texas Rangers baseball team. Well, the lawyer who handled the deal for Arlington, Texas, who died just recently, was the husband of Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, a conservative Texas Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I'd calculated the subsidy in that deal, about $200 million, maybe $201, and he told me, no, you're wrong, it's $202.5 million. Well, they sold the team for an increase of $164 million. So what does that tell you? Every single dollar that George Bush got from the sale of that team was taxpayer money that he arranged to funnel into his pocket, and the taxpayer money was because of a tax increase in an election held on an odd day in January when almost nobody turned out to vote, and they voted to raise taxes that would go to the team. So, you know, here's a man who is known as a champion of tax cuts, whose personal fortune derives from a tax increase that he arranged to funnel money in his pocket, and then he left about $38 million on the table.
Wow. All legal, I assume, right?
Absolutely legal.
Loopholes, but legal. Well, where's it all headed, David? I mean, where do you see this going?
Well, fundamentally, what's going on in this country is that we are, through government policies, redistributing upwards. And history tells us about that. Now, you didn't mention I have my newest book, which has been out since April, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, which is an anthology, and I've got contributions, chapters contributed to it by a whole host of famous people, and some not at all famous, but who are well-known in their field, epidemiologists, politicians, economists, Adam Smith, the man who figured out capitalism in 1776, all have chapters in the book. And one of the points I've been making in giving talks about Divided is that if we don't change where we're going, Plutarch has told us what will happen over 2,000 years ago. He said the most common and fatal ailment of all republics is an imbalance between the rich and the poor.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I don't think it'll happen tomorrow, but, you know, we already have seen polls in which, for example, and maybe these are anomalies, but there was one poll in which 44% of Republicans said that they thought what the country needed was an armed revolution. We've seen a number of polls where 12 or 13% of the public offered a series of options to solve our problems, pick armed revolution. And that would be the bloodiest damn thing the world's ever seen.
Sure,
Pol Pot would be reduced, Stalin would be reduced to an asterisk in history books if that were to happen. So we either will develop laws and policies that stop this taking from the many to give to the few, or we will at some point end up in terrible trouble. In the meantime,
it'll implode.
Yes. In the meantime, you know, what we're seeing is our roads are falling apart. Our education system is suffering. Our research, you know, that's what made America rich in large part is all the taxpayer money in the 20th century that we poured into scientific research. There are studies showing that more than a third of our economy today grows out of research we financed into math, physics, and chemistry in the first half of the 20th century.
I hit a pothole yesterday, David. I thought I needed a ladder to get out of it.
Yeah. Oh, it's the condition of our roads is terrible. And if you go, as I have done, to urban China, Singapore, Western Europe, there are no potholes. My wife and I actually 6 years ago spent 3 days in Stockholm. And everywhere we went, we asked, you know, if somebody knew where there was a pothole. And people looked at us like we were just crazy.
They didn't even know what potholes were, did
right,
they?
Right, right. Because they build their roads better and they take care of them. And therefore, they don't have nearly as many front-end alignment shops as we do.
Ben, let me talk to you for a moment about distribution of wealth. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with what's going on in Saudi Arabia, their laws, how they treat women and things like that. But I suspect that the kingdom, in order to stay in power and to grab the kind of wealth that they have, they distribute some monies to the people in forms of education, health care, things like that.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
that being done to keep them quiet?
Well, I would assume so. I have not been to Saudi Arabia. I've been to a lot of countries, but not that one. But we know that in a number of countries, governments see to it that, you know, under Saddam Hussein, gasoline was the equivalent of 15 cents a gallon U.S. And so, yes, governments engage in policies of various kinds to make sure that they don't face danger. You know, I teach in the graduate business school and the law school at Syracuse University, the law of the ancient world. And one of the points I make to my students as we're studying the business law and the tax law and the property law in Egypt and Sumeria and Greece is that, hey, you're the king. You don't want people fighting. You don't want wars with outside. You're not going to be able to do much about the wars on the outside, but internally you want people to get along,
That's
not
right.
cause trouble, do their work, and pay their damn taxes. And so you're going to set up policies that are going to make sure people aren't starving, because if people are starving, guess what? You get revolutions.
Well, and your guards are going to stab you.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so you set up policies to do this. But in this country, what we have is this massive upward redistribution that almost nobody knows about because it's done through incredibly complicated devices. And I'm sure some viewers, listeners, hearing me talk about some of the numbers earlier, you know, were like, wow, how do I follow that? That's the whole point. They make these things so complicated that they defy normal human understanding. And we pay very smart lawyers to come up with these devices and implant them into the law. And then we've cut the size of the news media so that there's very little beat reporting. We have plenty of investigative reporting, not enough, but plenty. But what we don't have is beat reporting. There are major federal agencies that no newspaper reporter, and that's where most of the serious news reporting.
Oh, those days are gone, David. They're gone.
Don't cover those agencies. And so they put in these rules you've never heard of to artificially jack up the price of electricity, to make you pay a tax to the pipeline industry, even though it's exempt from that tax, and yet you pay it every day. And, you know, if you could get a penny a day from every person in America through a government rule, a penny a day, at the end of the year, you'd have $1.1 billion. Huh. Well, the pipeline industry got a rule put in place, not a law, a regulation, that gives them 3 cents a day from every person in America. And so they collect $3.3 billion a year, supposedly to pay taxes, except they're exempt from this tax, so they pocket the money.
So
if you're an investor in one of these, by the way, you don't get the money. The managers sweep the money off to themselves.
Wow. Why can't we do profit sharing for Americans where, let's say, money that flows from the pipeline would generate enough profits and you give everybody a check at the end of the year?
Well, we could. I mean, that's what they do in Alaska, in Sarah Palin's state.
That's,
you know,
right.
Everybody gets a check from the oil industry. In Louisiana, however, we tax people to subsidize the industry. Actually, the founders did this. In 1792, Congress passed the first federal subsidy for an industry, the cod fishing industry. The British Navy was harassing our cod fishing ships in the Great Banks, and we counted on the earnings from cod sold outside the U.S. for a quarter of our foreign income. So wow. Thomas Jefferson, who was Secretary of State, was asked to come up with a subsidy for the cod fishing industry. Being a man of science, he ordered a study, and the study found that those ships that paid just wages were not very efficient. But those that had contracts negotiated in advance between the fisherman and the ship owner and paid the fisherman a share of the profits in addition to their wages were very efficient. So in 1792, Congress passed and President George Washington signed into law this subsidy law that required what sounds a lot to me like union collective bargaining. The workers have to have a contract negotiated in advance. They get wages and a share of the profits from the ship owners. And by the way, 5/8 of the subsidy went to the fishermen and 3/8 to the ship owners. We used to have that as policy in this country. We don't today. And if you want to see the decline in wages in this country, it tracks perfectly with the falling off of unions. And yet our economic competitors all have unions. We required the Japanese to have a union. General Douglas MacArthur, who wrote the Constitution of Japan, or at least was responsible for having it written, required unions so that there would be less inequality. All of our European competitors have unions. In Germany, the executives have unions. But here in America, we don't. And as a result, workers have no bargaining power, and their wages have been coming down steadily. In fact, the average private sector wage, my column for Al Jazeera America just went up about this. The average private sector wage in this country adjusted for inflation was higher in 1972 and 1973 than
it is today.
Today.
Yeah. Ford, by the way, for example, wrote checks of $8,800 to its UAW workers for the profits they made in 2013. That's a pretty generous check to an employee from a company. I wish all companies would do that, but they don't.
Well, Madison, before he died, wrote about this. The founders, and there's lots of material about this, the founders wanted to have yeoman farmers, that is farmers who owned their own land, not sharecroppers, not tenant farmers, and they wanted workers to own their own tools. Now, that doesn't work very well at the Ford factory, but the idea was you have a share of business. So Madison calculated the population of the country out to 1930 and almost hit it on the head, by the way, 100 years into the future, and concluded that there wasn't enough land for us to be all farmers. But, he wrote, if everybody had a share of business, everybody would have an investment and an income source that wasn't dependent
on something. There's no doubt. David, stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.